Good morning, everyone. Good morning and welcome to Perimeter Institute's grand opening weekend of the Stephen Hawking Center. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach at Perimeter, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all here this morning. I would like to welcome those people here in the theater. I would like to welcome those of you watching online and to those viewers across Canada watching on TVO. Also, a special note of thanks to our sponsors, BMO Financial, TVO, and behind me, the Christie Digital Wall. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to you, for a return visit to the public lecture stage, Professor Hod Lipson. He was here in 2010 and gave us a wonderful lecture on evolutionary robotics, which is available on our website. And he's back today to share the next steps. So Professor Lipson received his PhD from the Technion Israel Institute of Technology in 1998, and he continued to a postdoc at Brandeis University and MIT. He is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering and a computing and information sciences at Cornell University. He directs the computational synthesis group, which focuses on novel new ways for automatic design, fabrication, and adaptation of virtual and physical machines. He has led work in areas such as evolutionary robotics, multi-material functional rapid prototyping, 3D printing, I believe, and machine self-replication and programmable self-assembly. His research focuses primarily on biologically inspired ideas and brings engineering ideas to biology. Here now, with his talk on programmable matter, the shape of things to come, please welcome Professor Hod Lipson.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to talk a little bit about this whole area of 3D printing, an area that has been growing very rapidly in the last couple of years. It's been around for maybe 3 or 4 decades, but over the last couple of years, it's grown, and I think it's going to change our lives in amazing ways. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the ideas and some of the things that are going to follow from this revolution, some of the directions it's taking, and some of the challenges and opportunities that we'll face. So I'll tell you a little bit about this from a perspective of the way I got into this whole area. And it started with research that I did during my postdoc back in 2000 at Brandeis University. And we tried to look there at new ways to design robots. The idea that we had was that instead of designing robots at a desk, instead of sitting down and designing robots, we'll just breed robots. We'll take lots and lots of components of robots, we'll dump them into a big vat, we'll allow pieces to connect and reconnect in random ways, and we'll subject the whole thing to Darwinian selection, and we'll breed robots for doing something. Let's say robots that can crawl across a table or something like that. And so we set that in motion. It took a couple of days to run, and we got these interesting machines. But and you can see some of these right here shown on the screen. So these were all virtual machines bred in this kind of simulated Darwinian environment. But the question is, how could we move them into reality? How can we move these machines from the simulated world into the physical world and take that extra step? So before I go on, this is kind of the time that I was introduced to this fascinating technology called 3D printing. And now, for those of you who are not familiar with it, I'll just give you a quick idea of what it's about. So here's a, is there a message there saying something? Let's ignore that. So I'm sure you all know how a inkjet printer works. There's a printhead, it scans back and forth and spits out droplets of ink onto a piece of paper and gradually creates a picture. So now imagine that instead of those droplets of ink, the printer spits out droplets of plastic. So instead of creating a picture, it creates a sheet of plastic. Some places it puts material, some places it doesn't. It then moves up a tenth of a millimeter and puts another layer of plastic. And after a while, you actually get a three-dimensional object, all right? A real three-dimensional object, not a picture of a three-dimensional object, not a 3D picture, but a real three-dimensional object. Now, of course, there's no reason why you should limit yourself to rubber duckies, right? You could actually print other things. You can print anything. You can print convoluted three-dimensional shapes of any form that you like. So, for example, here you see this complicated geometry warped, entangled in itself, something that somebody designed on a computer would be a nightmare to fabricate in any conventional manufacturing method. But using 3D printing, you take this convoluted shape, you hit print, you go get a cup of coffee, and while you're drinking your coffee, the thing is printing, and you get this object right there. So this is a reality, and this is something you can do today. It works pretty quickly. In fact, you can even print the coffee cup. Why settle for one of those standard cups? So this is a real coffee cup printed, and you can really drink out of it. So these are functional objects that you can actually work with. So to me, this was an amazing revolution, to see this kind of machine that's available. And what's really amazing about this is that it really fits on your desktop. So this is not a factory that makes these things, but it's literally a machine that fits on your desktop. It looks something like that. There's a couple of them. Granted, this is a fairly big desktop, but it's a small person. I couldn't quite figure out what it is. But it is a fairly small factory that you can imagine that one day will be in your home. So going back to our story, I had these robots. They evolved in simulation for thousands of generations, and I wanted to copy them into reality. I needed to to get tenure, and I needed to do something that's a little bit different than everybody else. So we took these robots in simulation, and we copied them layer by layer, pixel by pixel, into the physical world, and here they are crawling around on the table, so on the floor. So these are robots that were not designed by a human per se. They were evolved, they were bred for this process of crawling, and they kind of transferred from this virtual world into the physical world using this 3D printing. So that was enough to make the news and to get me a faculty position, so first goal achieved. Here's what the New York Times said about it. This actually made the front page of the New York Times below the fold, didn't quite get above the fold. And it was, you know, in those days, that was back in 2000, you can get this kind of stuff onto the New York Times. And so you can, so machines making machines, and that's really what was exciting about it. You could see the design automation, the evolution, robots making other robots and so forth and crawling out. So if you take a closer look at this robot that I just showed you crawling around, one of the interesting things about it is that it has this convoluted shape that could not really be manufactured almost any other way. It would be very difficult. But nonetheless, we could only print the material, the body, the white material. But the wires we still had to manually put in, the batteries, the logic, everything else we had to manually put in according to the plans that were evolved. So one of the questions that we had then was, okay, how can we take this to the next step? Can we make a printer that can print the entire robot so that the robot will literally walk out of the printer, batteries included? Can we print the whole thing? And so this point, kind of my research forked into two different paths. One looked at evolution and making machines that are more intelligent, and that's what I talked about last year. And that's about the AI and all that, those sort of things. But what I want to talk about today is about this kind of quest onto making printable robots and making machines that can print complex integrated systems rather than just printing parts. All right, so before we go talk more about the actual story, let me tell you a little bit about the technology. There's about a dozen different technologies for printing. There's people keep inventing new approaches, But it's always been, it's been this idea that you can make a machine that can make anything. It's been around for a long time in the science fiction. You're probably familiar with Star Trek Replicator, the Matter Compiler, Fabers. It's been around for a long time. It's a repeating motif. Interestingly, all the science fiction, or most of them, in most of the science fiction stories, whenever people get their hands on a machine that can make anything, inevitably they blow themselves up. Nonetheless, we want to make one of those machines. And so the question is, how does it work? Okay? And Star Trek didn't quite reveal all the details. They just look at it, and it just appears in some way, and usually it makes a cup of tea, I believe. How does it actually work? So let's look at a couple examples. So people have been thinking about this for a long time, and here's one of the earliest approaches. It was simply a sheet of paper that is cut with a laser according to a pattern and glued on top of another sheet of paper, which is glued on top of another sheet of paper, and so on, stacked thousands of sheets of paper, each of them cut differently. And then you take this whole sheet, stack of glued pieces of paper, remove the pieces, and you have your final product made out of these stacked pieces of paper. Very simple idea. It's actually been implemented. This is one of those machines. You can see the reel on the left. And you can see the bottom right, you can see the actual printed kind of crankshaft. It almost looks like it's made out of wood, but it's really lots and lots of layers of papers. You can see from the kind of TV screen that's on the top right that it's a kind of 80s technology, right? All right, so that was really old, but that worked. It was very cumbersome, very slow, had lots of problems, and it used up a whole reel for every print and so forth. So it was challenging. But there's a lot of other technologies. I don't want to go through all of them, but some of the key ones, here's another one called stereolithography, which basically uses a laser to solidify a photocurable polymer layer by layer. The kind of laser draws out, sketches out the material contour at every layer. You can barely see those flashes of laser at the center of the picture. And the really dramatic point is when the whole thing comes out of the fluid at the end. And it's a very dramatic moment. But besides that dramatic moment, there's really nothing to watch. So it comes out, and it's very exciting. I mean, here you see a space shuttle printed out of material. So you can make really precise objects that way, and it's a very useful technology. There's lots of other ways to do it. Here's a process that deposits material through an extrusion head. So you have a feeder that feeds in a material in a form of a reel, let's say a thermoplastic. It melts it and gradually deposits it and builds a three-dimensional object. There's a lot more to watch. Here it's being accelerated about a million times because it's a lot slower than this. And gradually you can see here it's printing a kind of propeller. Again, something that would be a nightmare to fabricate any other way. So lots of machines that can make parts using this kind of process. And there's also a kind of powder-based approaches. And powder-based approaches they basically have a powder bed of material, and then they selectively agglomerate or join or fuse powder only where the part exists. So they will deposit glue or sinter powder using a laser or whatever to create this, make this powder join together to form an object. So that object ends up being buried in the powder at the end, and you take it out and you can get all these amazing objects here. They're printed in color. So these are all existing technologies. You can buy them off the shelf today. And there's a whole vibrant industry working around this. So you could be not paying attention at all to this whole thing, and you can just wake up now and you'll know exactly what the industry is focused on, making it better, faster, easier, cheaper. That's exactly what everybody's working on. Better materials, higher precision, faster printing, easier operation, all these different things. And it's kind of fairly, the path is fairly obvious. Everybody's kind of focusing in this direction. But I want to look a little bit beyond that. What is coming next beyond just making these machines more versatile and faster and cheaper? And so let's go back to our robots. So when we wanted to have our robots printed, we got to move beyond just faster and cheaper and more precise. We need to work on the ability to print functional materials. We need to be able to print the wires, the batteries, the whole thing. And so not every process that I described is amenable to working with lots of materials at the same time. And we need to work with multiple materials. But of the different materials processes that I described, in particular the deposition process and the inkjet processes, allow us to deposit multiple materials at the same time. So that gives us hope that we might be able to actually fabricate wires embedded in structures and so forth in interesting ways. And so there's a lot of these different processes around, but if I have to place my bets on which one of them will lead into making multi-material functional systems, it's probably going to be a kind of combination of these inkjet and deposition processes. And so we set out to build a printer that can make a robot that will walk out of the printer. And we created this kind of XYZ platform with multiple tool heads that can exchange materials. And this is a CAD picture of the actual printer. The actual printer looks much less beautiful. And so I'll stick with the CAD picture for now. I'll show you what it actually looks like in a moment. But this is the basic idea. It's a very simple concept. It's a kind of platform gantry system with lots of print heads, much like a multicolor printer, but in three dimensions. And so we use that to print with multiple materials. And one of the first things we did is to print a, this is a finger of a robot that had some silver impregnated silicone. So whenever it touched something, the resistance changed, so it could sense. So it's a kind of sensitive skin. We then tried to print a battery. And here's an example of a printed battery. It's interesting that you can open any textbook in chemistry and find out exactly how a battery works. There's no big secrets there, but to make a printed battery, the challenge is in finding mutually compatible materials. So for example, this particular battery is composed of five different materials layered in a particular way. So it's perfect for printing, but every battery has a turns out that it has a separator layer, which is usually a piece of paper. And we can print everything, but ironically, we can't print the paper. So we had to find a way to print a separation layer that wasn't paper. And so that was, we spent quite a lot of time trying to figure that out. And once we were able to do that, we were able to print a battery. You can see it at the bottom left there. And it's about half the capacity of a commercial battery. But it's printed, and that means we can make it in any shape we want. And so ideally, so that, again, opens the door to making batteries, embedding batteries in structures in ways that you can't do with conventional approaches. What about actuators and muscles? So again, with 3D printing, you're not probably going to print a electromechanical motor, electromagnetic motor, as we usually like to think about it. It's going to be some different form of actuation. This is an IPMC actuator. It's a layered polymer that when you apply a certain voltage to it, it bends. And so with that kind of, this is something that we could print, and that's going to be the muscle of the robot. So you can see how it changes the way we think about robotics if we want to print it. We have to think about different energy sources, different actuation methods, and so forth. This is one of our first printed robots. Evan Malone is a student back then who was trying to get this printed robot. He said he wants to have the robot swim out of the printer, not walk out of the printer. It's a little bit easier, and he made this this one, which has the battery and everything in it. Didn't quite work, so we still haven't cracked this one, but we hope we'll get it to move soon. So whenever I show this, people immediately ask, "What's the killer app? What is this good for? What are we going to print with this thing?" So This is a really tough question. And people have thought maybe it's going to be just to print parts that you normally fabricate in China. We can just print them with these printers. So maybe that's a killer app. But maybe it's going to be biology. There's a lot of people talking about printing custom things, and printing custom prostheses, for example, is something that's very useful. And people are exploring this. They take measurements, and they can print and fabricate things on demand. Now, there are a lot of applications that are interesting that way. Here's one that I think that's really interesting. This is a multi-material print of anatomical part, and it's a it's useful for studying, but also for letting surgeons practice. And I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but what do surgeons practice on, right? So they practice on cadavers, but cadavers are usually don't have the pathologies that surgeons need to practice on. So with 3D printing, you can fabricate pathologies for surgeons to practice on that they wouldn't be able to do that otherwise. For example, so this is an example application. Here's another thing. This is something that we do almost routinely now at Cornell and probably other places, assisted surgery. So occasionally we'll get an emergency call and they'll say a dog came into the vet school and needs surgery. It's being run over by a car. Its bones are shattered. They're going to go into surgery. They did a CT scan of the entire dog. They're sending us the file and we print all of the bones. Now, why do we print all the bones in 3D? Because we give them to the surgeon. The surgeons can practice the surgery beforehand. They can put all the pieces together. They can prepare the plates. And if you've ever put together a puzzle, you know the second time is a lot easier than the first time. And they can actually reduce the surgery time by half by doing this kind of practice beforehand. So you can see it's a kind of unanticipated application of this fascinating technology. Here's actually in operation. You can see the bones, the printed bones on the tray there on the left, and they're actually using those, and they're using those to bend the plates and so forth instead of doing that in situ. Here's another example. Using these rapid prototyping and 3D printing to make custom hearing aid casings, which need to be tailored to the shape of individuals. Not one size fits all doesn't work for this. This is a commercial application that's actually in practice. Printing implants. This is a titanium implant, jaw implant. So there's lots and lots of applications of this. This is an interesting application that we did in the lab. We're actually printing live cells. So we take live cells, in this case from cartilage, live cell from cartilage in the meniscus, cartilage of the knee. We culture those cells, we put them in an ink, in a hydrogel, and we can print a new meniscus from the original cells. And we can print the meniscus in the shape from the CAT scan of the healthy meniscus. So if you're looking to get replacement menisci, this is probably the way it's going to happen. In the future, you'll be able to print original parts. This is not a plastic replacement. It's your own cells printed into what is the original shape. So is that the killer app? So we don't know. So there's actually the things that is generating money right now in 3D printing are printing figurines. People like to make and print things that are unique. And so if you have Rock Band figurines, you can print those. World of Warcraft figurines. People say this is a new way to make friends, right? And so you can, so that might be a killer app. Here's a different, but maybe it's going to be education. This is a 3D diagram of thermodynamics, of how pressure and temperature vary over time in a gas and volume. So why is it, why does it look so ancient? It was prepared by a professor back in University of Washington for a blind student. The student wasn't able to see the three-dimensional relationships, so he created this clay instrument so that the student could feel and see how the volume and the pressure and the temperature relate to each other by kind of feeling it. And so that kind of thing was unique to that very dedicated professor back in University of Washington. But today, we can capture this, and any visually impaired student can download and get a copy of this and feel it. So you can see implications here to educational material that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And so, for example, we have at Cornell this collection of old machines, teaching models from the late 1800s, which were used to teach kinematics. So it's a unique collection, but you have to travel to Cornell to actually play with these machines. Well, not anymore. you can download a copy of these machines, and if you have a printer, you can print your own, and you can turn the crank, and you can see how it works. And so teaching models are kind of an interesting application of this whole area of printing. But what's the killer app? This doesn't sound like the killer app. So what can we do with it? So, you know, instead of trying to guess, it's notoriously hard to guess what a killer app is going to be. And it reminds me of the early days of computers. So there's a clear parallel here between the printers and computers, right? So in the 60s, those of you in the computer business might remember, the first mainframes came out in 69, the PDP-11. They were expensive, they were big, they were slow, they required trained staff, and they were maintenance intensive. Today, they're fast, cheap, small, easy to operate. The printers today are following very much the same kind of paradigm. They're very big, expensive, and slow, but they might be following the very same curves. It's difficult to get numbers for these trends, but definitely the sales of these printers is growing exponentially, and I only have data from a couple of years ago. So what's the killer app of computers? So I don't know if any of you remember this ad. This is an ad put out by Honeywell trying to figure out what's the killer app of computers, how they're going to get computers in the home. So they kind of knew that there's a big market for computers in the home, and they thought it was going to be in the kitchen, and they came out with this kitchen computer. And it makes you cringe to read what they say at the bottom, but that's what they thought. That product was a flop, but what wasn't was this one. And when you ask historians what made the change, how the revolution of computers happened, many of them will point at this particular instance. It was the first computer that came as a kit that people could build their own. So until then, there was this vicious cycle of expensive computers. They were very expensive, therefore they had a very narrow market. Because they had a narrow market, they had narrow applications, and they remained very expensive. But the moment this DIY computer kit came out, lots of people could build it. It was about $400 back in 75, so about equivalent to $2,000 today. You could build your own computer, and then the whole thing took off. Suddenly, people built the computers and wrote software. There was a reason to buy the computers because there was software. There was a reason to write software because there were enough computers available. And what was the killer app? It was gaming. Gaming is the thing that IBM and Honeywell could not anticipate. Who would use a computer to play games? What a waste, right? Turns out that's the biggest application, at least at that time, and the whole thing took off. And you could assemble those, and it was a whole community of hackers playing around, and that's how the software came on these paper reels and so forth, and this is what it looked like. So we decided to try to do the same thing. Let's abandon these very expensive $250,000 printers that I showed you before, and let's make our own open-source, hackable 3D printer. And so we made, and we weren't the only ones, there were a couple of different groups working on these open source 3D printers starting a couple of years ago. This is a fab at home, which is the one that we did at Cornell. Here's a Model 2, which looks a little more Apple-ish. There's a couple of different types. They all come as kits that you can download the parts. You can have the parts cut out of with a laser cutter in any one of a million places. You assemble them like IKEA furniture, and within a couple of hours, you got yourself a 3D printer. You can put any kind of material that you can squeeze out of a syringe. Easy cheese is excellent. Rheological properties for this kind of stuff. And you can make stuff with it. And people have been making all kinds of things all over the world with these printers. And making them and changing them. It's all open source software, open source hardware, fabathome.org. So, and there's a couple of these. This is the RepRap, which many of you might be familiar with, which started more or less at the same time and also grew into MakerBot, which is the most well-known of these open source 3D printers, and the revolution happened. So when we started with this, I talked about this revolution happening in the future, but it already has happened. So the number of 3D printers of hackable open source 3D printers is exceeding the number of conventional 3D printers, and it's the tens of thousands. So it's happening, and I just came back yesterday from Maker Faire in New York City, where the place was littered with 3D printers making all kinds of things. So importantly, we focused on multi-material, so we can really print everything from cheese to titanium. Actually, no, this is stainless steel. Literally printed in stainless steel. We print with stainless steel powder in a gel, any shape, and then we put it in the oven and bake it and sinter it into a three-dimensional object. And you can print with different materials, with rubbers and cement, and make all kinds of interesting things and so forth. So people are playing around with this, making all kinds of things, iPods and so forth, and robots and bicycle gears, and it's just taking off. But what's the killer app? And business people are scratching their heads and asking, what's the killer app? And the killer app, I think I know what it is, and I want to show you. It certainly took me by surprise. It's cooking. Digital cooking. So this is, what do I mean by that? One of the things that people really like to do is print with food. Print with chocolate, with peanut butter, with cookie dough, with frosting, anything that can come out of a syringe. Now, I know for some people it sounds disgusting, but for others, you might imagine this ability to design pastry in any shape, in any filling, in any combination you want, and hit the print button, go get a cup of coffee, because that you still need to do yourself, and then come back and the thing is made for you. So this idea of making food using software digitally is appealing to a lot of people, and we found that people are playing with this and doing all kinds of interesting things. And in fact, this is some work that Jeff Lipton, one of my students, did with Daniel Cohen and Chef Dave Arlens at the French Culinary Institute in New York City. Playing around with these different, with scallops and celery and turkey and whatnot, and printing all kinds of things, deep frying them. I don't know how they tasted, but it's interesting. This is a deep fried corn, printed in a squiggly pattern while it's being fried, and that was on CNN. And I didn't think that the thing I'll be most well known for is deep frying corn, but this is the thing that seems to have had the most impact over this entire 3D printing research. This is a cab driver stopped me in New York and said, "You're the guy who's printing fried corn, right?" So this is my thing, because the U.S. really needs a new way to fry corn. All right. So, but here's a really interesting application. This is a cookie. Okay, it looks like a regular cookie, but you cut it in half, and there's text inside. A new way to send passwords. So you can see here how you can play around with these things, and your imagination is the limit. So I really didn't think about this as a killer app, but I think that food printing is for 3D printing what gaming was from computers. It's one of these things that, why would you use a 3D printer to do that? But it turns out it brings people who couldn't care less about manufacturing or robotics or CAD or design suddenly into this whole area. And so maybe it's a way to do education. And so we are trying to use this kind of idea of 3D printing with food and different materials to bring people into engineering. And interestingly, we're aiming to do this at the fourth grade. So I think that trying to bring high school kids into science is a bit late because they already made their decision. But if you can get kids at the third and fourth grade to suddenly like engineering because they can do these things, we can really go somewhere. So with Glenn Bullitt, University of Virginia, we are trying to bring these printers into elementary schools by printing with these mundane materials and seeing how they affect kids. So it's really interesting to see how this whole printing affects education. It doesn't affect education because you can print teaching models like I showed you before. It affects kids because it empowers them to make things. And few people have ever, few adults have ever seen anything being manufactured. But when you show a kid how their idea turns into reality in front of their very eyes, they are empowered that they come up with new ideas. We just did a summer camp at Cornell where we took kids and we allowed them in 1 week to go from concept to selling physical products online. In 1 week, not a semester, not 4 years of education, in 1 week from idea to selling physical products. And it was the empowerment was incredible. And the questions were amazing. Kids were suddenly asking, what happens if somebody steals my idea and sells it as their own? Which is the first time I heard a teen ask it from that, ask about intellectual property from that perspective, right? But suddenly they're interested in this kind of thing. So it's really interesting to see how that happens. And that's, I think, one of the biggest impacts. If you go online to shapeways.com and lots of other repositories, you will see tens of thousands of products that people are putting up, designing and selling online, incredible things, all print on demand, literally tens of thousands. So I think this is really a revolution in the making in terms of how people design and make products, who designs them, where they're made, and the scale-up of industry, because you can start from something small and gradually grow. So how can you design things? And you might be thinking, okay, I want to do some of this 3D printing, but how can I design something? I don't know engineering. I don't know how to use CAD, computer-aided design. What can I do to design things? And this reminds me of something we call in the lab the Earl Grey hot problem. So what is that? So if you look at Star Trek, they have this incredible machine that can make anything. And what do they make with it? Tea. They keep making tea. With this, they have a machine that can make anything in the world, and that's what they make. Sometimes they make cheesecake, I think. But that's about the extent of their imagination. So interestingly, I found the same phenomena in the lab. So we bring students and we say, look, you have a 3D printer, it can make any shape you want. Now design something. And they think about it for a while, and they come up with a block with a couple of holes in it. But it's a machine that can make anything. Why are we stuck with this conventional manufacturing paradigm? It's very difficult to stare at this blank page of opportunity and take it and explore it. And I find that to be one of the biggest frontiers in terms of our research, is how to explore this huge design space. I want to be able to tell a machine, I want to hold two or three bars together, find the optimal shape that does it. I want to explain that, I want to hit enter, and I want to get the machine the shape that does that. I want to create these esoteric materials. I can combine hard and soft materials into bizarre combinations to make unnatural materials that nobody's heard of. This is a combination of hard and soft material in a particular pattern that when you pull on it, it expands laterally. So you know, most materials, like a rubber band, you pull on it and it becomes narrow. Most materials behave like that. But you can print a material that when you pull on it longitudinally, it expands laterally, an unnatural material on what is called an oxetic material. This is an example of a bizarre behavior that's very difficult to anticipate, but we can fabricate on demand. How would people know to look for these materials in this new vast design space? And this is one of the things that we're just beginning to look at. Here's an example of optimization software that actually searches for optimal shapes to achieve a particular goal. And I think we're going to see more and more of this AI approaches to design, where you don't actually design things, you just say what you want, and the machine designs it for you. Maybe we can do something else. Here's an example of going from a freehand sketch into automatically, a computer reads the sketch and creates a three-dimensional object as a way to interact, to bring people who are not traditional engineers into design. So this is something we worked on for a while until we realized that there are fewer people who know how to sketch than people who know how to do engineering. So we abandoned that, and we came up with this idea. This is a pretty recent thing. It's called Endless Forms. You can go to endlessforms.com and play around with this. This is a completely hands-off, relaxed way of designing. You sit back and you watch a screen full of random shapes. Now you want, let's say you want a face. Okay, you want to design a, you know what, you want to design a lamp. So you look at these and you say, I like this, I like that, I don't like this, and I kind of like this. It takes your input, it tries to figure out what you like and what you don't like, and generates a new combination of shapes. And you don't need to know anything, you just click on these things, you see what you like and you don't like, and you get these interesting things. These are a couple of things that people have designed, people who have no experience whatsoever in engineering were able to create these objects. And there's in 1 month, there's been almost 2 million objects generated on this website. And there is, of course, a 3D print button where you can print this out of almost any material. We've printed a couple of things in solid silver, and we had to explain that to accounting, but we wanted to see what it comes out like. All right, so I want to end with the last kind of direction of where this whole area is going. And this is something that I'm really excited. We haven't forgotten about our goal of really making a robot that can walk out of the printer, batteries included. And so everything I showed you so far is kind of analog in the sense that material is deposited anywhere. But what if instead of depositing material, we can deposit tiny, tiny components? Tiny components the size of the grain of sand. And each of these components, some of them will be passive, some of them active, some of them smart, some of them dumb. And together, they will be the thing that we want to make. And so instead of ink, imagine these small materials, small components. So if we think about it this way, we will move, as Neil Gershenfeld from MIT coined the term, we'll move from analog materials to digital materials. They will look the same, but really they'll be composed of lots and lots of small building blocks, not unlike Lego, but really, really small. So just like you're looking at the circle right now and it looks smooth to you, but if you zoom in, it's made out of lots of pixels, you can imagine objects made out of 3D pixels or voxels. And if the voxels are passive, you get structure. If you have conductive voxels, you can also print wires. If you have resistors and capacitors, you'll be able to print 3D analog circuits. If you have CPU voxels, you can print computers and so forth. So if we have these building blocks, these tiny building blocks that are functionalized, we'll be able to really print three-dimensional objects. So the question is, how will we be able to assemble all these gazillion building blocks together? And the approach is going to be kind of a parallel approach where we pick and place millions of these components together. So this is an animation that we prepared a while ago. We couldn't quite figure out how to do it, but recently John Hiller, a student in our group, figured out a really neat way to pick up millions of pieces at the same time. And the idea is very simple. He shakes all these pieces on the tray. He then wets a plate, projects an image on that plate, a bitmap. That bitmap selectively dries the water in some of the areas and leaves other areas wet. Then he presses this plate against the array, and only the wet places will pick up the component, just like a wet hand in sand will pick up grains of sand. So it's a neat way, and with that idea, he's able to assemble nylon and copper objects and so forth. And here's another example of trying to print a rook out of lots of beads. This is a more of a kind of inkjet approach to printing objects out of voxels. It's assembling objects out of lots of small components. In this case, the components are spheres, so and it's accelerated here, and it's gradually printing the three-dimensional object out of these components. And what you get in the end is a kind of rook assembled out of these lots of small beads. And you can imagine that in this future, these beads could be functionalized. They could actually contain these different, some of them can contain circuitry and so forth. So you can, on a bead this scale, you can put a web server without any problem. So at the end of the day, you get this kind of three-dimensional object which you can hold it. So this in your hand. So this is a kind of, think of this as a low-resolution digital object, okay, made out of 3D pixels. And of course, in 60 years, you can say that you remember seeing the first object that had only 10,000 pixels in it, and nobody will believe you. So this is what it looks like, and of course you want to functionalize it, put stuff in it, and eventually make these into a tiny, tiny powder that you will barely be able to see. Here are some of these voxels right now. They're about 500 microns on the side, and they interconnect like Lego. So, of course, this is not limited to structural components. You can functionalize them. You can even make tissue components, beads of tissue that you can print together to make heterogeneous tissue back to the application in bioprinting that we mentioned before. All right, so I think this is really the future of this whole printing because it's a move from analog to digital, and we've seen a lot of technologies move from analog to digital, communication, computation, and I think that printing and manufacturing is going to go in the same way, and it's beginning to happen now. Digital manufacturing and digital matter is really happening. So, to sum up and to conclude, you will have a factory in your kitchen. And for those of you under 20, I promise you that you will have a hard time explaining to your grandchildren how you lived without a printer in your kitchen and how you actually had to wait long 24 hours to order something and get it shipped to you the next day. Whereas now you can just download a blueprint of a toothbrush and print it and have it in the next half hour. So this is really what's going to happen. In the last three decades, we've moved from being able to control and print the form and shape of arbitrarily complex objects, which we already can do. We're now beginning to be able to print the internal composition of multiple materials to make bizarre and complex intertwined objects. And the next thing is to print wires and batteries and components and processors so that you can literally download your own iPod and work with it. There are lots of new interesting challenges and opportunities and new design space to explore, new kinds of materials, and the question is, how is it going to affect your life in the future? So I want to sum up with this idea that there's really, people say that human evolution is distinguished by the invention of tools. And that's really the big difference that made humans unique. Well, 3D printers are the ultimate tool. And I think that's going to profoundly affect the way we continue to evolve. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's start the queue. The microphone is here. If you do have a question, just get out of your seat, make your way to the microphone. We'll take as many as we can. And I believe our first question is ready to go. Please, go ahead.
I find it's extremely fascinating, the whole presentation, but I'm just wondering if there aren't kind of two sides to this here, whether this ever occurs to you that in some way, especially in bringing this into schools and elementary schools, we're maybe raising a generation of children who have a large separation or enhancing the separation between the individual and the natural world, in the sense of you go into an elementary school, there's kids fooling around with the plasticine and this kind of thing and creating objects with their hands in contact with the world, and now we have, well, you can do that, but isn't it cooler if you have this $100,000 machine that intervenes between you and the natural world? So is there a kind of a cost to this in separation? How would you address that?
Yeah, so I think it's a good point. There is a separation that happens when you make things using the machine rather than doing it manually. But I believe that most people don't make anything, do not have this hands-on experience that you're referring to. And to a large degree, society has lost the ability to make. So while it would be good if people actually made things, this might actually bring it back. But the right balance has to be found, and you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question number two.
Yes. Well, I'm wondering of a machine that can reproduce itself completely. How far do you think we are from this goal?
So how far are we from a machine that can make itself? So there's a, this is one of the kind of more esoteric questions that have to do with riprap and printers that can print pieces of printers. I think certainly printers can print parts of themselves, but to what extent a machine can print all of the components necessary to make itself is a really fundamental question. I think no analog machine can do that at all because there is always a degradation in the accuracy. The only way a machine can print a complete functional, identical version of itself is if it's completely made out of digital material. In other words, it's made out of these components. So if you're interested in this question of replication, which is a very kind of philosophical one, I think the approach would be through this digital materials. But it is also a very practical question because if we can make machines that can make machines that can make machines, you can really you know, revolutionize manufacturing at a much faster pace than conventionally. So it's a good goal to have.
Well, thank you very much.
And the next question, please.
Hi. I'm Doug Moe, and I'm a director at Quartz Lab, which is a makerspace in Kitchener. Now, we have a RepRap machine. And we have an outreach program where we get kids to make things, but we haven't actually combined the two things yet. And after seeing your talk, it seems to me that what we should be thinking about is getting one of those syringe deposition devices with that supports multiple materials and getting kids to produce food. So now we're on a budget, so the question is, are there like open source designs for a machine that works the way I just said?
Yeah, so everything I showed you is open source. If you go to fabathome.org, you can download it. It's about $800 in parts. We don't sell the parts. It's truly open source, so you have to get your own from various places, and you can build it. And you can put any material you want in it. The chocolate, though, is on you. So it's
okay,
not included.
So the Fab at Home will support multiple syringes and be able to switch between them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect, thank you.
Next question, please.
Hi, how about clothing and shoes? It seems to me even more than food, that's a case where people care about customizable shapes and patterns.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Actually, I had quite a few slides on clothing and shoes, and I took them out because of time. But yes, people are printing shoes. Because you can print hard and soft material in different colors, so you can buy a 3D printed bikini for $400, but it's custom fit, and it's fairly coarse knit, if you ask me. But it's still possible. So people are exploring this. It's definitely this whole area of fashion. I think if you look at Shapeways, which is where a lot of these things come out, because most people don't have a printer at home, but they post it and it's print on demand. Most of these things are fashion accessories. So from earrings to pendants to shoe accessories to new heels, it just goes on. The human creativity is just amazing, and that's one of the biggest areas. Absolutely, maybe that's the killer app.
Thank you.
And another question, please.
Hi, so I was listening to this whole thing, and I'm kind of wondering, what kind of bonding, like what's holding all these things together? Are you using hydrophobic, hydrophilic type interactions, or is it just kind of, they just sit beside each other? Like what's holding these things together? And also to add to that, as you're dealing with different materials and the different interfaces, how is that impacting? Like, is there something that you have to take into consideration when you're dealing with multiple interfaces and how they interact with each other?
Absolutely. So the interaction between the materials is a key challenge in multi-material printing. So the interaction between materials, having, mutually compatible materials. So printing metal and polymer at the same time is very tricky because of this different temperature. So that's why I think digital printing, or rapid assembly, as we call it, is really an approach where you can have these multiple components that click together and glue together like Legos rather than fuse together using some of the other techniques. But there's, a dozen different techniques of combining these materials with glues and fusing, and they're all different and different technologies.
So the main strategy is more with the shape, rather than a force to hold
them. Some of them are interlocking shapes, some of them use glues, some of them are fused by heat. There's lots of different approaches.
Thanks. Thank you, and we have time for one more question.
I notice you speed up the printing process by 64 times. Is there a method of speeding up the printing process that you have thought of? And how? What is the limit of like the smallest object you can print?
So this has to do with this commercial trends for making machines that are faster, cheaper, and more precise. And people are working on this, and there's lots of great ideas. Excuse me. The fastest material printers today can print about a cubic inch in a, I'd say, 10 minutes. So they're fairly fast, and about 10 microns precision. So that's roughly, it's on par with any conventional manufacturing method that's on demand.
How come nobody uses, like, or you've used, like, one inkjet at a time? Why isn't there, like, parallel printing?
Oh, so all the commercial processes are absolutely parallel. So you have multiple nozzles passing and complete rows. Absolutely, parallelism is essential.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in congratulating and thanking Dr. Hod Lipson.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.